Welcome to the Hills Church Podcast. Hills Church is a four-square church in Laguna Hills, California. Visit us on the web at hillschurchoc.com.
In fact, if we're really honest with ourselves, there are even moments as Christ followers that we wonder if it actually works. I have. I wondered, like, how all of these things make sense and how all of these things kind of connect together. And what I've come to realize is that it's not just the information. It's not just the scores and the facts that we use to compare whether or not this way is better than this way. I think it has to do with being open to a whole new paradigm, a whole new way of thinking, developing a worldview that incorporates God into our greater consciousness, if I can say it this way. So as I started thinking about this series, I needed to confront one of my own assumptions. And one of my assumptions is, I know that I've been created to be loved by God. But what is there in me that is drawn to the transcendent, that is looking for answers that are beyond just my experience? So I started this whole series with this idea, why is it that we even believe in the first place? It's easy to believe in things we can prove. It's easy to believe in things that we have experienced. But that does not explain why we believe in the things that we can't prove, that we just feel, that we just intuit. Because whether you, it seems that everybody in the world believes in something. Even if you quote unquote believe in nothing, there is something in the human condition that yearns to know. So I wanted to start off this idea of helping us to develop not just answers on why maybe Christianity is better than anything else that we wanted to compare with. I started wanting to ask the question, why is it that we believe in the first place? So I want to look at three particular things that I'd like to suggest to you. The scientific advancement of the last 20 years, specifically within the areas of neurology and genetic mapping, people are starting to ask questions if we're actually physically, biologically designed to believe. There's a new science that's out that's been developed in the last decade that is called neurotheology. Neurotheology. It's a study that it's a discipline that studies the effect that spiritual practices have on the brain. This gentleman by the name of Dr. Michael Ferguson did a study where they placed volunteers into a functional MRI machine. And this would allow them in the MRI to track the flow of blood to the brain, right? That when they have certain experiences, which part of the brain is going to be the most active. And so the participants were given instructions To begin to think about God, whatever is the God experience to them. And it was funny, while they were in the MRI, they had a little machine that allowed them, the instructions were simply this, that they were to, while they were thinking about God, they were to touch a button to signal when they felt most connected to God. Like all of a sudden, maybe some of us have had that experience even here, right? As we're worshiping, you come in and your mind's not all of a sudden focused. And then all of a sudden, our awareness of God becomes very real. So they were asked to just hit this little button. And what was interesting was that these scientists, the researchers, identified a consistent elevated neural activity, meaning that when they were thinking about God, there were certain parts of their brain that began to engage at a much higher level. How close are we, Justin? You're there? Almost. So I'm going to give you, we'll get to the picture here in just a minute. But there were three areas of the brain that they showed had an increased activity when people said that they felt that they were most connected to God. The first is the nucleus accumbens, and this is the pleasure center kind of at the back of the brain. It's the area of the brain that kind of rewards you, that releases all of those dopamines into our system. Excellent, Justin. That's the bottom one. So you can see in that bottom red box that those were the areas that were heightened. At the same time, the medial prefrontal cortex, and this is a part of the brain that affects valuation, whether or not something is important or not. It involves judgment and moral reasoning. Hey, Bub, you'll have to move that into the... Good, thank you. And that is the section that is there in the moment. It's also, what's so interesting is that this middle section of your brain controls your ability to reason, but also your ability to feel or to translate this information into emotion. And then as you would expect, that the frontal attention region that is used to bring focus and attention also shows highlighted activity. These are actual scans of individuals that have been compiled who went through this experiment. And my conclusion, and some of the people who are beginning to study this, suggest that when we focus our attention to something that is transcendent, beyond ourselves, that maybe we're actually designed to do that because of the response that it produces in us. Like the fact that, I know that chocolate's not good for me, but chocolate is good because when I eat chocolate, it releases the dopamines and makes me feel better, right? It's interesting that as we worship, as we draw our attention, that those same type of chemicals that tell me that something is good, that something is right, begins to be released even physically in my own system. Why would that be a surprise to us that we would discover it? It's the fact that we just now are developing the capacity to be able to measure some of these things. Not only in our brains, but some researchers look to see if there's a genetic connection. So one researcher believed that since spirituality can be described, and it can actually be measured by the way in which someone lives their lives or the choices that they make, he began to ask if it could actually be defined in a clinical way and be quantified. So he began by looking at DNA to see if there were any indicators that might predispose someone to spirituality in the same way that someone might be more predisposed to addiction, or that your genes might lead to a greater propensity to obesity. He wondered if our DNA, if our genetics kind of lend to those types of preconditioned, is it possible that we could be preconditioned towards spirituality or to believing? And this Dr. Dean Hammer believes he's found a connection between a specific genetic marker and spirituality. Now, I want to be clear that while his findings are not conclusive by any means, the idea that faith would be embedded in our design code, in my opinion, cannot be entirely dismissed. I think if there was something in which we've been designed in his image and in his likeness, that the same yearning that God has for himself would be embedded in us, and the desire for us to make a connection with God himself. Now, Dr. Hammer goes on to say, while our genes might predispose us to believe, they don't tell us what to believe in. And in the old nurture versus nature debate, this is why why and how we believe often tends to be a product of both. Where we grew up, our environment, our culture, and it's combined with this maybe innate capacity or this innate need that mankind themselves has a desire to believe. Now, I'm going to tell you, it's my personal opinion that, and I'm going to offer a lot of my personal opinion. I don't consider myself to be an expert in these kinds of things. But I'll tell you what, I believe that if we were designed by God and created for a relationship with him, that it would not be outrageous to think that we would have a longing for him. I think it's something that the author of Ecclesiastes was onto. Justin, if you'll go to the next slide, one more. In Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verse 11, this person who is writing this whole book on the meaning of life and the value of life makes this one little sentence that I think is really, really significant. That when thinking about his life and his relationship with God, he came to this conclusion that God has planted eternity in the human heart. That it's not just that we have the capacity to live forever. That it's not just the fact that something... I think it is about the idea that God has... being made in his image, has placed some of that eternalness in us. And we long to continue to connect to it. This isn't just describing, I think, the eternal nature of man, but also the wonder and the wondering that humans experience. From another version, the Common English Version, Ecclesiastes 3:11 says this: God makes everything happen at the right time. Yet none of us can fully understand what he has done. And look at this. And he puts questions in our minds about the past and about the future. Now, I don't know about you, but that often describes my relationship with God. I have questions about the things that have happened, the whys, and I have questions about the what. And I think it is something that God placed in our lives, this wondering. Rather than pre-programming us to have a specific response, I think he placed something in the nature of mankind to always be in a quest for answers, because I believe God knows that those answers will only be found in him. I think there's some thought that maybe physiologically we might be designed for a relationship with God. I also think anthropologically that we is a basis for why humankind believes. Anthropology is the study of cultures and the study of the development of human beings. And that, when you go back to the earliest of study, we'll spend some more time with this next week, but like we would call it the caveman days, right? That there is physical evidence that people worshiped something from the very earliest times. The first markers that we have of human existence not just point to their own personal experience, but that involved in that existence was this worship of something or for something. In fact, from the beginning of time, I think we see that humans always thought to find meaningful patterns in nature that they would make sense of the world. And we infuse those patterns with intentional agency. What do I mean by that? Like, there's got to be something that makes something happen. Right? When I was a kid, an example being that, you know, if you wanted rain and you grew up in the days of cowboys and Indians, then you think that it would make perfect sense to do what as a request for rain? Do a rain dance, right? There is always something that said, like, if I want this to happen, then there must be something that I would have to do in response. Dr. Michael Shermer, the author of The Believing Brain, calls these two processes, next slide, please, calls these two processes patternicity and agency. And what this is that human beings are always trying to find reasons, right? They find the patterns. Oh, this is happening. So the next question they want to find out is, why is this happening? What is happening and why does it happen? And so in our need to settle these kind of questions, human beings have created their own stories, their myths to explain the reason why. Now, in our Western culture, we are most familiar with the stories of the Greek and the Roman and the Norse gods, right? Thor, he's one of the reasons why, you know, things would happen in the world. Zeus, the reason why things would happen in the world. And we've always been able to try to explain things that we didn't fully understand by making up even some kind of story to explain why these things happened. But the problem with that is that our experience is so diverse that no single explanation would exist. That's why you would have, if you wanted a good harvest, you would pray to one particular kind of God. And if you wanted to curse somebody, well, you wouldn't go to the God who would give you blessing. You would go to the God who causes all kinds of bad stuff. And you would ask him to do you a favor by making bad stuff happen to the person that you want. If you want a good harvest, you want to win a battle. Every situation had a different God. Maybe write this. This is an important idea that's going to carry us through. Every different God every situation had a different God that you either had to appease, right? And what does appease mean? Anybody? Huh? Make happy. Or really, appease is not to make angry. It's different. You had to make sure that he wasn't mad at you. Or there's the opposite of to please, to make sure that he was happy with you. So if we don't even know that these external forces that are at work, whether or not they're mad at us, I'm doing whatever I can so that it's not mad at us, or I'm doing whatever I can to make sure that they're happy with us, we still live in the same dilemma. We still have the same problem. Something is happening and something is causing, and we still don't have the answer. Next slide, please. Next one. So I think there's something even philosophically in the way that human beings have been designed that causes us to want to believe. Christian philosopher and author C.S. Lewis wrestles with this idea in his book called Mere Christianity. In my opinion, Mere Christianity is probably one book that every believer needs to read. because it begins to help us process some of the questions that every person of faith always has. And the premise of this book is, why does mankind look for something to believe in? Why does mankind have to believe in anything? And he suggests that there are some things that are common to every person, these two intrinsic drivers. Now, I'm kind of summarizing my understanding of what he has, and my terminology might be a little bit different from what you'll find in the book. But if you'll go to the next slide, please. C.S. Lewis suggests that in every human being, that there is the sense of awe. That there is this, both this kind of fear and affection, this drawing near and this afraid of sense that every human being has. But along with that, in their createdness, there also is this intrinsic sense of morality. Because no matter where you study, people are aware of what is right and what is wrong. People of every culture intrinsically understand what is good and what is evil. It's not an external code. It's not something that they learn. It's something that you are born with. And if those things are true, then what human beings look for is an answer outside of themselves to explain those things. And we call that entity. What is the source of that awe? Like, why do I feel that? And where did this sense of morality not just come from, but more importantly, who is the evaluator of what is good, of what is evil? What is the, I call it this way, what is the source and the force? What's the source of awe and the thing that enforces that sense of good and bad, evil and justice? Who's the one who ultimately makes that kind of decision? So we understand the first two, awe and morality, but what we don't, what mankind has always struggled with is this idea of entity beyond us. And I think that's where the origin of religion really begins. We take these three things, awe, morality, and entity. And in whatever way we can make sense of it, we make up a code, something that we can follow, something that can be evaluated, and something that we experience. It appears that since the beginning of time, people have been asking these types of questions. And since the time of Adam and Eve, since they were driven from the garden, the scripture describes people as always being on a quest to find these answers. In fact, the very next generation, following the example of Cain and Abel, we have this scripture. Genesis chapter 4, verse 26 says this, "And at that time, people began to call on the name of the Lord." As early as the second generation of human beings, the scripture tells us that people began to search for God. People began to search for God. What's funny is that the Bible describes different ways that people began to do that. Just two chapters later, in the book of Genesis, we find people building monuments, mankind building monuments to what? Their own God-likeness. The Tower of Babel. That what they have decided is that God is us. Or the God that is out there, by our own knowledge and by our own effort, we can do what? Make that connection. It's so interesting to me that the first description of religion in the scripture is not relationship, but is effort. God's out there, and when I build a tower big enough, when I can get his attention through my own efforts, God will finally notice me and we will be able to connect. The Bible continues to describe throughout the Old Testament the different efforts and belief systems that people have that are beyond him. The system of Baal worship, where you would, like Greek or Roman mythology, where you would attribute certain gods or idols to making sure that you get what you need, that my livestock would be preserved, that the invading army would not win over us, that all of these efforts and sacrifices were the same kind of system that created this idea that something else has to be at work. And if it is at work, I want it on my side. I think the whole scripture describes this journey of people wanting to believe and wanting to engage with a transcendent force that would be at work on their behalf that they had not yet been able to fully discover, because also in human nature is our own need to find our own solutions. In the book of Acts, the Apostle Paul encountered this. In fact, he began to comment on mankind's quest. Look at what he says in Acts verse 17. He's in Athens, and he is on what they call Mars Hill. It's a gathering of the philosophers and the seat, as we would know Rome to be the head of the Roman Empire, the seat where Julius Caesar would rule from. We also know that Athens was the seat of Greek culture. From the times of Alexander the Great, as Alexander began to bring along all of the Greek philosophy of Homer and Plato and Socrates, people are beginning to ask these questions about the experience and the existence of humankind and trying to find and make sense of it all, reasons why life happens the way it is. And as Paul is in the center of this kind of debate, he has the opportunity to address some of these thinkers, and he says this: I see in every way that you are very, what? Now, we define religion being a code that you make up to explain the awe and the morality and rationalize that with the force or the entity that's beyond you that makes you feel this way. Are you tracking with me? Right? He says, as he's standing, how many of us have seen ruins in Athens? Right? You've seen pictures of it, right? What are those ruins of? They're of temples. They're of temples. And Paul's standing there, able just to look around the city. And they're not ruins at this time. These are huge monuments. He says, I see that you're very religious. For as I walked around and looked very carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription: to an unknown God. And I think that this is what most of mankind wrestles with. That you are ignorant of the very thing you worship. So here's what I'm going to tell you. The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth. And he does not live in temples made by human hands. And get this, and he is not served by human hands. It's not about your rituals. It's not about your effort. The answers that you are seeking are not found in your practices or in your own ability to try to make sense of the patterns and circumstances and situations that have happened over your life. He's not served by human hands, I love this, as if he needed anything. Do you not see how silly that this is? That a God who is in charge of everything needs me to do something for him. But that's very much the kingdom of me. That's very much the idea of me somehow earning God's favor. I love this. He says, rather, he himself gives everyone and everything life and breath and everything else. Next, please. From one man he made all the nations that they should inhabit the whole earth. And he marked out and appointed their times and histories and the boundaries of their lands. Paul's giving an explanation on the why. Right? God has done this. But now he gives the reason why. Verse 27. God did this so that they would what? I want that to sit with you for a minute. All of these things that human beings try to find meaning in, the reason why we try to do that is because that's what it's intended to do. It's intended to create and to tap in to that God part of us that wants to be connected. And it asks us to start to ask questions. God did this so that we, humankind, would seek him, and I love this, and perhaps reach out for him and, anybody? And find him. And then I love this thing that Paul says, and he is not far from any of us. He is not far away from any of us. Last slide, please, Justin. So we begin this journey about why we believe and why Jesus. We need to understand that it has been mankind's quest from the very beginning to find God. But it's been God's purpose from the very beginning to be found. And if God's desire is to be found by all mankind, what do you think the enemy wants to do? To create systems and codes and performance-driven behavior that keeps us looking here instead of looking for him. When we begin to look at all of these other belief structures and belief systems, the main thing that I want us to understand is not how these things contrast against the Bible, who's right and who's wrong. I want us to look at the worldview behind these things. I want us to start to ask the question, does this belief structure direct us to God, or does it direct us to me? What I need to do, how I need to behave, how I need to change, how I need to somehow please some outside force that I can't control, but maybe I can tap into it and things will start to work for me? Or is it possible that the reason why we believe the way we do is because God has committed himself to being found by us. Jeremiah 29. I'm wrapping up right here. I'm going to be done. And thanks for your extra time. I know it's 11:30 and Jeremiah 29:11. How many of you have heard that verse before? Right. I know the plans I have for you, God says. Right. In fact, I always think of it like this because I think that there's a context to talk about this. He says, I know the dreams I have about your life. And they are not to harm you, but they are for your good. They are so that you would understand that there is a purpose to your life and to your existence. That there's a promise of my partnership with this. And then, but then the prophet goes on and he says this, so interesting. And when you know that, when you choose to believe that, then you will seek me.